Blog Talk Radio.
Pleasant surprise. You want to do some yapping today? I'll plug you in, only if you talk shit about Anthony. I shouldn't say. All right. Welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. I am Matthew Aaron. You are listening to the Evolution of Radio, www.thematthewaaronshow.com, at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter. That's where you go when you tweet me all the nasty shit you guys tweet me. I should turn your microphone on. Is it on?
It's on.
Okay, it's on now. You go to Twitter, at Matt Aaron Show. I think on our Twitter, people talk more about, like, what I'm doing in, like, my free time than about the show, which is...
No, they don't.
No, sometimes it's about the show, but a lot of the time it's like, dude, you were hanging out with Victoria from the WWE. Let's talk pizza. I'm like, hey, whatever, pizza, yeah, great. We're on Facebook at The Matthew Aaron Show. You type in The Matthew Aaron Show, you click like. It's that simple. Then you get all the updates. And if you've been on The Matthew Aaron Show's fan page, then you very well know tonight's guest is Mark Waters, who directed, among other things, Vampire Academy, which is coming out on DVD in the upcoming week. But, of course, Mean Girls, Freaky Friday, Just Like Heaven, Ghost of Girlfriends Past, Mr. Popper's Penguins, and his first feature is one actually that was an indie film I saw when I was 14 called The House of Yes with Parker Posey. And we're going to talk about his career. And we're going to talk about your guy's favorite, Lindsay Lohan, among other things. So don't worry about that. What else am I on? Stitcher. You can listen to me on Stitcher. Go to Stitcher. You can listen to really anything on Stitcher. Don't be that impressed. You can listen to Lenny playing Angry Birds on the toilet if you go to Stitcher. I'm pretty sure there's a whole page for that. You know what you should – Caesar and Pat, if you're listening, you should get us on Podcast One. That's the next step towards getting us, like, another, like, 5,000 incremental listeners from, like, all these different places. Put us on Podcast One, because I'll be interviewing Jim Ross next week. Good old JR. Good old JR. That's a plug already for next week. I'm pumped about that. We're going to be talking wrestling.
He's staring at me.
We're going to be talking about his podcast. We're going to be talking about...
wrestling.
We're going to be talking about his one-man show he's doing, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to be doing that show from the Squared Circle with Lisa, with Victoria from the WWE. I don't know if she'll be on. I got to ask her, I guess. I think she wants to be. I think it's more up to me. We will see. I don't know how I feel right now. What else? Maybe I'll get Nick Searcy to join us, too. Stitcher. I know I'm missing stuff. iTunes. You can go on iTunes. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. It's so easy. You hit the fucking subscribe button. Family show. You hit the fucking subscribe button. And it just goes right to your fucking device that you subscribed it with. Your iPad, your iPhone, what do you got there, a burger from Teddy's? So because I couldn't go to Teddy's because I had to go to the gym, you still went to Teddy's anyways. You go, you want to do dinner tonight at Teddy's? You were just going to go to Teddy's no matter what. It was more like you can go if you feel like it. I'll be there.
It's on the way to your house.
Yeah, it is on the way to my house. Well, it's right down the block from you, too. It ain't that far, pal. Don't act like you're doing me any favors. So iTunes, you can leave comments on iTunes, though. You know, I give a shit and I don't give a shit. Whatever. As long as people stop sending me emails. These emails, though, last week about the Hillary Winston interview. I'm glad everyone loved it. I'm glad everyone's watching Bad Teacher. I hear the ratings are steady. Hopefully it gets picked up. And, I got a lot of positive emails saying for, you know, Hillary Winston, she's not an out-there star. She's not on E! She's not an actor. She's a TV creator. She created Bad Teacher. And that so many people who probably, I don't want to say they don't give a shit about behind the scenes because we have a director on today, and that's our audience. We have actors, but we also have directors and writers, and people don't know behind the scenes, but.
She was good on the show.
She's great. You were listening. That's right.
Megan,
you told me.
Megan and I listened. That was actually Megan.
Did Megan like it?
She liked it.
You lying right now?
I'm not lying.
She dozing off.
No, she liked it a lot.
She have a pregnancy excuses while she was listening? She's like, oh,
I need a tub of ice.
Yeah, right. She probably took a walk to Jewel herself to get it to not listen to the show. No, don't worry. I'll walk to Jewel. No, I don't need the car. No big deal. 9 months pregnant. I'm going to walk. No big whoop. Hillary was great, and people were really happy with all the behind-the-scenes stuff. They really got to figure out how a show is ran, how a show is created, how a show works. So that was awesome feedback to hear. I mean, I'm sure we're on other things like, of course, you can go to the MatthewAaronShow.com. That's the easiest and best way to listen to the show. I'm sure we're on other things like Blog Talk, Fuck You Radio.
Kosovo.com.
Listen, they had an episode this week. They claim their number one podcast right now is an episode they did with the wrestler from the WWE, Bad News Barrett. You're telling me when I had Edge on, former 58-time world champion, that number may be skewed a little, but former world champion numerous times, huge fan base. And this guy, Bad News Barrett's number one podcast? Oh, please. Please, who are you bullshitting? Who are you bullshitting? I had the number one podcast. I probably had last week with Hillary Winston. I probably had the week before with Sean Astin. You know why Blog Talk doesn't like us? Because I cuss. And I'm not a black woman. Most of their shows are ran by black women.
Oh, my.
This is
the
like,
MatthewAaronShow.com.
My show is if you put us on BET at 3 a.m. And they're like, there's a white guy on BET. That is my show on Blog Talk Radio. So, you know, whatever. Mark Waters joining us, the director, of course, of Freaky Friday, Mean Girls, Just Like Heaven. And, of course, the upcoming on DVD, Vampire Academy, which if you didn't see in theaters, you can catch on DVD. We're going to talk to him. Alex Luisi's joining me in studio.
What's up, guys?
And I believe Steve Weirich's on the phone. Let's Steve?
Oh, it's Steve.
Ahoy, hoy. I'm here.
Ahoy, hoy.
I already got
Ahoy, ahoy. Well, you had someone successful in the business on last week. How about someone unsuccessful like me? Because I have a dilly of a pickle here that I got to tell everybody.
Wait, you don't have a seven-figure deal with Sony TV, Steve?
No, I actually applied for a writer's program for Hispanics.
Oh, that's a $7 deal at Sony TV. Continue. Yeah, continue.
Steve, you still that was a
two-peso deal. So
now,
does anyone know,
I hope our audience knows how white you are. You make Barney Gumbel look like a Bill Cosby. Okay.
Well, that's the thing. So I found this free writers program where they send you to Burbank for 7 weeks. They give you $250 a week, and they fly out there. They put you up. So I'm like, oh, this is wonderful. I do like an hour and a half worth of work. I touch up all my scripts. I bullshit about myself the whole nine yards. And then after I submit everything, after I sign my life away to ABC and NBC, I look at the top of the application. National Hispanic Media Coalition. Oh, fuck. God damn it.
Why do you think they're paying $250 a week in cash?
I'm having a hard time making the
Mexicans out there, okay?
I can't make $250 a week in cash right now.
The gardener at Jerry Bruckheimer's house makes $250 an hour in cash, okay?
I'll say this. Under the frequently asked questions, there was a spot that said, do you have to be Hispanic? Did say no. It is open to all races.
So there was a couple people that were like, now wait just a second. This is affirmative action. And they're like,
that's what I said.
Whatever, dumbass.
With any luck, I can be like with the Koreans. Maybe the Hispanics will like me too.
Well, you could have put minority.
So, yeah, when you filled in the Scantron, why didn't you say you're Hispanic? Who's going to question
there,
it?
There was no, Wyrick. Yeah, real Hispanic. I need to be like Wyrick.
Your mother is a Rodriguez.
Oh, yeah. She's about as short as one. Yikes.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, you could be the lost Mencia child.
El Stevo.
There was no Scantron. It was I did have to spend like a month's wages to fill all this crap out because you had to print it all out, scan it, and email it.
Don't tell me you FedExed it. Don't tell me you went to Kinko's and spent that sweet time.
No, I bankrolled that prestigious Columbia College degree I have, and I made them let me use their ink and their paper.
So, in other words, you stuck into Columbia College and you just use the computers.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I did.
That's exactly what you did. That's probably how I'm going to edit our movie. So.
Well, that's more than fine because I'll walk in, I'll flash my ID, and I'll just tell them I'm still a student. I'll get on in and I'll edit.
And there's so many students there. How the fuck do they know? They don't know.
Steve, technically.
Exactly. They don't know.
You're technically
Alex wants to know if you go in for this interview, who interviews you? Hector Elizondo? Edward James Olmos?
I will shit every pair of trousers I own if I even get that far. They notify everyone in July and the submissions just started. So
okay. All right.
It's your move.
All right. So you could get a phone call on set of our film in July. And be flown to Burbank because they think you are from the clan of Gabriel Iglesias.
Yes, because I'm just as big. Oh, that's what I should have done. Steve for references,
Iglesias.
I should have put him down.
Yeah, you should have put down Puffy. You should put, is that his name Puffy? What's his name?
Fluffy. He's Fluffy, not Puffy.
Puffy. Listen, I'm thinking of Sean Combs. I'm thinking of every minority nickname I could think of. There's Puffy, Fluffy, when you're the fat Mexican version of Puffy, I guess, even though he doesn't really do anything that Puffy does. But, okay. I guess my name would be Fluffer. Wait, that's what you do in porn. What's that shit called? No. What's that, like, marshmallow shit called that you could spread on white bread?
It's fluff.
It's fluff. I'm fluff. He's fluffy. And then there's puffy. So I'm just fluff. I'm not fluffy. I'm just fluff.
Steve could be fluffer.
Right. I'm like, yeah, Steve's the fluff. Steve, that's how you get back out into the valley, pal. I mean, it's not exactly West Hollywood. It's not exactly Hollywood, but you get back out in the valley by volunteering your fluffing services.
You know what's sad is I do know someone. I do know a director who worked with Peter North, so I actually
You use Fluffy as a reference, and they'll be like, well, the guy is in the Fluffy business.
Well, I can use my buddy Craven Moorhead. I can use his name.
Craven Moorhead?
There's a guy in the business he directs. He actually does music videos and porn. His name is Craven Moorhead.
Oh, you told me about Craven Moorhead. That's this guy's name that Steve knows. He's a porn director and, I guess, an actor.
He's a porn.
Among other things.
Mm-hmm.
Craven Moorhead.
That's Craven Moorhead. I'm gonna let him know he got plugged today.
I thought that was pretty good, Craven Moorhead. I thought it even took me a minute to realize that was like a porn pun. I thought he was just thought he was Craven Moorhead. I'm like,
the best was going to Milwaukee with him. I got all the great porn stories out of him going to Milwaukee. It was wonderful. Hour and a half of porn.
You spent an hour and a half of time in a car with a guy named Craven Moorhead?
Yes. Yes, I did.
And how much more did he get?
All of it, I guess. I don't know how to answer that
question.
Oh,
really? All right. You just admitted that on the air you gave him all of it.
You know he wasn't paying for gas.
No. He didn't pay for gas.
I was working. Oh, here we go.
Yeah.
No. Craven Moorhead, yes. There you go. You know, Caesar's always looking for us to plug new products on the show so we can get sponsors and promotions. And we go ahead and plug Craven Moorhead. This is what I do to make stress easier.
Well, the adult industry loved you.
Industry loved me. It's just a funny thing. Cesar Marconi, one of our esteemed producers, does not want to make money off the adult film industry. He'd like to make money off of the Hollywood film industry, the one that's on the other side of the alley.
Right. Okay.
Well, you just make your money where you make it, huh?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Steve, you were doing movies with black lesbians at one time. You know better than anybody. You make money the way you got to make money.
Oh, I actually almost lost money because they paid me so badly. It was 500 for 5 days. It was pretty bad, but
Can I match you on how pitiful your life is, Steve? Can I give you my story for the day?
Yeah, go for it.
I went on a date this week. You know where I went? You know where we went for my date?
Where'd you go?
We went to the Stratford Mall. And you know where we had our star
that
cuisine?
That still exists?
You know where we had our 4-star cuisine?
Well, where? Olive Garden?
Sbarro.
Oh, not much better. Holy smokes, you ate at Sbarro?
If that's not a recipe for all the
sex. They're going out of business.
There is one wide open in Stratford Mall.
They're filing for Chapter 11.
They are filing.
After
I had that pizza the other day, I can tell you why they're filing.
They're restructuring.
Oh, are they restructuring? Which is always, or we're out of business.
No.
That pizza sits under the light for hours and it's not good.
Well, they heat it up. They put it under the heater for a little bit.
Sbarro's or Bocce's?
Well, we went to Sbarro because
Luisi answer that question.
What's better than is Sbarro or Bocce? Oh wow, you got me on the edge of my seat here.
That's why I said let Luisi answer that question.
I'll tell you what, I bet you Bocce's may actually be healthier somehow. I'm not saying either's healthy. I'm saying Bocce's may have better ingredients.
That's all I need to know.
But Sbarro has better flavor, I think.
Next quote.
Listen, Sbarro's awful. You're asking me to compare diarrhea to solid shit, but I'm telling you, Sbarro's kind of the solid shit in this equation.
Listen, this isn't me being a dick. It wouldn't be filing Chapter 11 for no reason.
The funny thing, it was my date's idea. It was between that or the esteemed Cinnabon.
Cinnabon's good.
I was going to say, wait, was Fazoli's closed?
Well, the only thing I wanted at Cinnabon were those balls they make, the cinnamon balls, and then they put the cream inside the ball. But my date goes, they have those at Taco Bell for cheaper. And I'm like, What's your fucking point? They're not as good at Taco Bell. Tell you that.
You would have been better off to ask her if you take her back to your house.
These are
Chef Boyardee.
These are fresh balls they had there. Okay. Oh yeah, yeah. Bruce Fretz goes, "Did you stuff her shell?" I go, "Oh, that's such a good pun, Bruce."
What's he come back?
By the way, Bruce Fretz says one of the best films of the year was Fading Gigolo. Lenny, Mikey, and I went to see it the other night. Three thumbs down.
Wow.
Way down.
Bruce, where were you at that one?
The same place he was on Drive, which I don't care how much Ryan Gosling's in it. That man's not good looking enough for me to like an hour and 30 minutes of nonsense. Terrible. But Bruce...
Yikes.
Bruce had too many fruity drinks.
That's right. That's right. He had too many fruity drinks. He went to see Fading Gigolo. He saw a lot of himself in Woody Allen. And he goes, this is a great movie.
You can relate to Woody Allen, though.
Yeah.
But he also made us go see Bucky Larson. So there's two strikes for him.
Well, that's because he didn't want to see Bucky Larson, and he asked me to do him a favor.
That's like seven favors. That was the worst movie I've ever sat through.
It is the most terrible film I've ever seen, probably. I think it could be the worst film ever. This is all the boxes for moving, pal.
Oh, I thought this was all baby shit. I was going to start taking this home.
No, it ain't baby shit. There's nothing in that Huggies box but some fresh love, pal.
Are you trying to steal baby products from their house?
Listen, I've been trying to get money out of the bro for the film for the last 3 weeks. He's going to take whatever he can get right now from the looks of it.
Oh, man. That's a bad topic I
told Giuliano, you can't show up tonight. I gotta take out the fire hose and put out the steam between you and Luisi because Giuliano's got a big yapper. You know, when you're working with multiple producers on a film and there's argument, like there's always going to be. And everyone's friends, by the way, too. It's not like when people get mad at each other that they don't want to be friends anymore. It's just business-wise they're like frustrated and don't want to do business. And so Giuliano is not, I mean, Alex isn't the only one at fault here. Giuliano makes comments and he gets a little stressed and he sometimes crosses the border on some of these comments. And I didn't even know what was going on yesterday, but Alex is blowing up at me. Giuliano doesn't know what the hell's going on. I go, that's because you think everything you do is innocent. You need to shut the fuck up too. So now I'm putting out four here tonight. You're missing out, Steve.
Well, when it's all said and done, Giuliano's going to look
at film?
Me.
Can I just
make a fucking
film? Well, we get back to shooting in 2 weeks, which I'm excited about.
Yeah.
I gave you those dates, right? For our listeners, we are shooting in May, June, and July, and then the film wraps in July, and then I'll be editing it in May, June, and July. I'll also be in L.A., though, working on the pilot and some other projects we got going on, so... So it's going to be quite the juggling effort, but this film will be done by the fall. And I mean,
no rap party, no rap party.
We'll have a rap party, sure.
By the way,
I want to make a plug for someone else's podcast before we have Mark Waters on. Mark Waters, of course,
Steve Austin,
of Vampire Academy, Mean Girls. You know Steve, of course, Steve Austin. I'm listening to this show today. He's got the best show.
I've been listening to it for a while.
If you're into professional wrestling, it's great stories. But the first 15 minutes is just Stone Cold doing his thing. Just, you know, he's talking about
his wife.
He talks about his life. Well, yesterday was his wife. Today he was talking about how he had a fart at the gym. And he almost shit himself. And it's one of the funniest stories I've heard in a long time. And it's done only the way Steve Austin can tell it. So if you're not listening to Steve Austin's podcast, you're missing out on... First of all, he puts Mark Maron to shame. Mark Maron should go retire because if Steve Austin can do 15 minutes to open that are funnier and less pretentious than Mark Maron, that's a problem. And if you ask me, even when Steve has on guys like Gabriel Iglesias or movie stars like he has on too, and he has on famous music people, all kinds of people, his interviews are better than Maron's too. I don't really get all this Maron hype. I'll be kind of honest with you. I don't get it. I'm not saying the guy's not talented. I just don't get the hype. Good publicist.
Yeah.
I tried listening to an interview he did with Jon Favreau once. I was falling asleep. I tried listening to another interview he did with Robin Williams once. I was falling asleep. Listen, maybe it's just me. It's just my taste. But
You can't talk. You got to let Rob Williams talk. You can't talk.
Yeah. And the other thing is, Maron just comes off as like a poor man, Stone Cold Steve Austin. He's no Steve Austin. That's all I'm going to say.
Wow.
Open that can up, all right, pal?
Well, there's another can you could open, too, that rhymes with Kevin Pollak, but I don't think you want to.
Oh, can we not Kevin Pollak again? Listen, I have no beef with Kevin Pollak. I think Kevin Pollak has a beef with me. I have no beef with the guy. I've read his book. I like his stand-up when he actually does it and doesn't just talk about
it. I'm positive he doesn't like you.
He got a book?
I like his acting.
Yeah, he does have a book.
Yeah, he's got the book, and, you know... I
mentioned your show, and he wasn't thrilled.
Yeah, I remember. Steve mentioned my show once to Pollak at a stand-up thing, and Pollak wasn't having any of it. And I guess there were some hecklers in the crowd that didn't
Steve
like...
Steve was throwing tomatoes, I bet.
Well, there was hecklers in the crowd that didn't like Pollak, and Steve told me that one of the hecklers... was dropping my name.
Oh, you said one of the hecklers was Lenny.
No, one of the hecklers was dropping the show's name or my name, and Pollak was getting really pissed.
Why?
I don't know.
No, When I was working at the Improv, Kevin Pollak had a bunch of sold-out shows, and the way it all started is he was just reading from his book.
Too. Not usual stand-up sellouts where they give out tickets. Kevin's show's legit.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know.
No, he was taking the door. Like, he was taking everything that sold at the door he took. So these people stood up and they go, "We didn't come to a fucking book reading. You're not funny." And then after that, they started dropping Matt's name, and Pollak stopped the show, refused to go on until they were kicked out,
and
I had to kick him out.
Are you serious?
Steve's texted me while
this
is going on.
Hey, Steve, guess who paid those guys to do that?
The best thing was, literally, the best thing was literally like, what was it, a week or two later, who do I see at Phil Rosenthal's house and hang out with all night? Kevin
really?
Pollak.
You see,
and Pollak came up to me. Pollak came up to me, and he was a great guy. He was great. But then I saw Pollak again. I went somewhere. I saw a movie for Ricky Jay, and I was sitting next to David Mamet. And you're like, wow, I'm sitting next to David Mamet. So everyone's going to come and want to kiss our ass and say hello and blah, 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 right? Pollak walks in. He sees Mamet. He sees me. He takes his girlfriend. He beelines and goes to the other side of the room, all the way to the opposite corner, as far away as he can get from me. Not horizontally the opposite corner, diagonally the opposite corner. So he could get away. And everyone's like, well, maybe you're paranoid. Maybe he wasn't trying to get away from you. Maybe he wanted to sit front row all the way to the right-hand corner. No one likes those seats, bro. Nobody likes those seats. Mamet and I had the best fucking seats in the house. And if you weren't sitting next to me and David fucking Mamet, you didn't have good seats. Who sits in the... When you go see a movie, Luisa, you sit front row, right corner? You're turning your neck the whole time.
No.
Your neck's up in the air. You got one side on your shoulder. You got the other side cranked in the air.
I'm a center left kind of a guy.
Exactly. That's where we were. Well, no, we were back left. We were in the Lenny and Matt seats. Mamet sits in the Lenny and Matt seats.
Yeah.
And where Terzo and I, we all sit when we go to the movies.
Yeah.
Don't
be too close.
Yeah.
Or bad.
So I don't know if Pollak hates me or what, but I'll tell you this. I get a vibe. I do want to
forgot about you.
Yeah, I do want to bring up Mark Waters' movie that he is coming on to promote because it's got a DVD release coming up here. It's from the Weinstein Company. Maybe you heard of them. It's Vampire Academy, which is based on a book, and it's, you know, it's about girls in like, you know, a vampire school. First of all, we're going to talk about it with Mark. Because I have my theories on why he was asked to direct this film, but I don't know if he was asked or he brought this film together. Because Mark's directed a lot of similar films, and Mark's also produced, like, 500 Days of Summer, which is a good film. So I'm kind of curious how that all came together. We also want to ask, of course, about the 10th anniversary of Mean Girls. We want to ask about, you know, I got some other questions. He's worked with the biggest women in the business. And I think he's really smart. I don't know if it's just been planned that way. That I don't know if he plans it that way, that he chooses to work with the biggest women in the business. Or, I mean, like, that's his game plan. He's like, well, maybe because there's less big women to work with than big men, I can, like, conquer the female territory, like, just like Heaven with Reese Witherspoon, or Mean Girls when it was Lindsay Lohan and Rachel McAdams, or Freaky Friday when it was Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan, or Ghost of Girlfriends Past where it was Jennifer Gardner and Matthew McConaughey. So it's like maybe he has this market cornered. So, I got a lot to talk about him.
He's a professional.
Yeah, I got a lot to talk to him about it. He's definitely doing something right. So Vampire Academy, it was in theaters, and I'm telling you, this is going to be one of those films that comes on DVD, and it's going to be a real big cult hit with the DVD audiences and the video on demand, because all these high school girls are going to sit at home and eat this thing up with a fucking spoon like it's Lucky Charms.
The Mean Girls originated, that whole...
Yeah, oh, and I believe Mark's calling in now. Steve, I'll call you after the interview. Are you going to keep listening?
Well, yes, I will keep listening. I'm on my phone. I don't know if it's good enough to listen, but I will do my best.
Well, give it a tune in. You may like some things you hear. I know you have your opinion on all this Lindsay on OWN, and you and I both liked Mean Girls. We thought it was a great film.
Great
movie. So there's things to talk about.
So, all right, yeah, I'll put my headphones in and try and listen.
Well, I'll yap with you when I yap with
you. Adios, El Stevo.
Yeah, and good luck with the Hispanic Coalition Screenwriters Program.
Thank you. Yes, I'll need all the luck. See. All right.
Yeah, see. You're the Bumblebee guy on The Simpsons. Have a good one.
Yeah, all right. Bye.
Steven Spielberg.
Are you my via?
Mr. Spielberg. Mark Waters, is this Mark? Or who else is calling in? I never know who's calling in. It could be 80,000 people. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Mark, it's Mark Waters. There you go.
How are you?
How's your evening?
I'm good, great. I'm glad I could reschedule my usual show to do this with you. It was important for me to interview you. I mean, this was a big deal for me because I happen to enjoy pretty much, I think, all your movies. I've been going through your resume yesterday. I mean, I totally forgot about The House of Yes. I totally forgot about it. It's something that I don't think people bring up as much as they should when they bring up The Clerks of the World and the El Mariachis and all those films that came out in the mid-90s. I kind of want to start with that, and we're going to talk about Vampire Academy and the Mean Girls 10th anniversary and Freaky Friday and all that. But The House of Yes, how do you put this project together? Is this your start in the business, or did you have a start in the business before it? Kind of give me the rundown of how you got involved with the business and how that movie came together.
Yeah, you know, it definitely was my start. It's interesting because I after I graduated college, I had kind of a, you know, the classic 20s, you know, wandering poet vagabond phase where I didn't really know what the heck I was doing. Actually, I was doing it before that was even in vogue. I think in the 80s when I left college, like, people actually knew what they were doing and they went to law school or business school, and I didn't have any clue. And so I just traveled around and made money doing odd jobs and landed in San Francisco where I ended up working in theater. And it's interesting, The House of Yes was a play that played in San Francisco at the Magic Theater. It was a big hit at the Magic Theater in San Francisco, but essentially bombed everywhere else. It bombed in New York, it bombed in London, it bombed, I think, in L.A., and so nobody really noticed the play, but in San Francisco, where I thought this is one of the best, greatest plays I ever saw, and I'd never done a single thing with a movie in my life, but I remember calling and hunting down the agent of the writer saying, I plan to make a movie of this play someday, and she said, well, who are you? And I'm nobody, but could you send me a copy of it? And I got a copy of it, and I remember giving it to my brother, who at this time was actually already in Los Angeles and was a working screenwriter. And I think, you know, he wrote the movie Heathers, and so he read it, and I remember he actually kept it where all the Waters brothers keep their reading, which is by the toilet. And he'd go in there, and I hear him laughing, and he'd be like, this is funny, you know, and I feel like, okay,
like
good,
shocked.
You know.
I like how he's kind of shocked that it was funny. Like, Mark, really?
This is good. You know, and then we kind of forgot about it, and then, you know, and in the intervening time, I ended up getting into film school. I kind of got tired of theater and started making movies, got into the American Film Institute, came down to Los Angeles and you know, went there for 2 years. And then, you know, after I graduated, I kind of wrote some screenplays. I even got, one of them got me an agent. But everything I was writing was kind of very, very ambitious with, like, elaborate sets and a lot of characters, and nobody really wanted to give me money to make a movie. And so I said to myself, you know what, what can I do that has a very small amount of characters in a very contained location that's still not going to, that I could still make cinematic and make it not boring? And then I said, oh, my God, it's the house. And yes, that would be amazing. And I remember calling my brother saying, and going over there and saying, hey, do you remember that play, The House of Yes? Remember that you were reading it? Do you know where it is? And he's like, I don't know where it is. It's like, you know, and I read it in the bathroom. I literally went into his bathroom, and there on the ground, moldy, underneath a bunch of other magazines and everything, was this waterlogged copy of The House of Yes, which I plucked out and ended up contacting the agent and kind of negotiating. My sister was a lawyer, and I had to write a contract. And we basically negotiated a cheap option, and I, you know, kind of proceeded to get that thing set up, you know, and I wrote the screenplay myself and got these producers I went to AFI with to join up with me, and, you know, got the movie cast with Mary Renew, and then suddenly, you know, when I had Parker and Genevieve and Tori involved, suddenly people with a very small amount of money wanted to come up and be part of it. And we had like a $1.2 million budget, and we were kind of gearing up to shoot. And then the interesting thing that happened was that Tori's dad read the screenplay of the movie she was going to do, and suddenly we got called in for a meeting with Aaron Spelling. We went and sat down at, you know, in his monstrous office, and he, you know, talked about how much he loved it and said, guess what, I decided I'm going to buy the movie. So he essentially bought out the other investors, gave us a little bit bigger budget. I think the total budget was $1.5 million. And so ended up being able to make the movie. You know, I still shot it in 23 days, but it was more luxurious than the run-and-gun style I was planning on. And that's how the movie came into being.
Was there any thought in the back of your mind when you're working with Tori that it somehow could at least get into Aaron's hands and could become a bigger deal? Or is your only thought because I'm talking from a producer's angle. Put your producer's hat on, not directing, not writing. From a producer's angle, are you thinking, well, this helps get the movie seen more? Maybe Aaron Spelling sees it.
You know what? At the time, I certainly didn't have that thought. Maybe my producers are way smarter than I thought they were and more Machiavellian than I give them credit for, and they actually thought that this might be a scenario that might come to pass. I certainly didn't, you know. And if anything, I thought, oh, God, we got to keep it away from him because it deals with, you know, incest and people mimicking the JFK assassination. Maybe if he sees this, he might pull the plug and say she can't do it. So I was more concerned about the other way than him being a help, you know, but it ended up working out well.
Well, it worked out really well. I got to assume, I noticed there was like a 4-year gap between that movie and Head Over Heels, which Head Over Heels, that was the Monica Potter one, correct? Am I wrong?
Yes. Yeah,
okay.
You're right.
I am right about it. Okay. So there's a 4-year gap. You do have a special thanks credit for Requiem for a Dream during that time, which I think is fascinating. I kind of want to know how that came about. But can you explain why the 4-year gap? Because the movie did well, House. Yes, it was an indie sensation.
Well, the quick answer to Requiem for a Dream is that Darren Aronofsky went to film school with me at AFI, and so, you know, he and I used to always share our scripts with each other and give each other notes. And I think I even read Requiem for a Dream as a novel when he was just dabbling with the idea of doing it. And I comically was the one telling him not to do it. But I did say to him, if you're going to do it, I don't see the point, because it's but you definitely want to focus on the mother. The mother's the only story that holds my interest. You got to make sure that becomes the centerpiece of it. You know, I think, you know, he got Ellen Burstyn, and then I think he got an Oscar nomination for it, actually. But the thing with my career with that back then was that I immediately, when I finished the House of Yes, I said, okay, great, I'm going to make my magnum opus that I was going to try to make before the House of Yes. And I tried for years to make it, and just couldn't get it set up. And I thought, well, I have all this heat now. Shouldn't I be able to parlay it into making the movie I want? And the answer was no. You know, and interestingly enough, I actually shot the movie head over heels in 1999, and we thought it was going to come out in 1999, but then it ended up getting, like, punted for almost an entire year, where we did reshoots, and there was a glut of Freddie Prinze Jr. movies on the market, so they decided to pull it and hold it back. It was all very unpleasant, that experience. But the fact is that I wasn't like I was idle during that time. I was just kind of struggling to make something, that beating my head against the wall that just wasn't going to get made.
Does it help at all that your brother was so prominent in the business? He's someone I would love to talk to. I mean, your brother Daniel, for people that don't know, he was a studio screenwriter back when they hired screenwriters pretty much just for a studio, which they don't do so much anymore. But Daniel was doing films for Warner Brothers and all sorts of films. I remember he did Demolition Man, I believe, and Batman Returns, and he did Hudson mm-hmm. Hawk, which, I mean, I could talk to him about Hudson Hawk for 2 hours alone. Does that help? Does that help having a family member like Daniel, who already has some precedence in the business, with getting your career going at all?
You know, my brother is the most kind of inept, dysfunctional human being you'll ever come across. He's never had a driver's license. You know, even back when he was a successful, you know, screenwriter in Hollywood, he still didn't have a clue how to, like, you know, program his VCR. I mean, he's that kind of guy. He's actually like a, you know, almost like a screenwriter savant, where it's about the only thing he can do besides tie his shoes. And so he's completely useless for me in the business. I don't think he ever made a phone call on my behalf, nor would I want him to. But I think the thing that he did give me was confidence that I'm like, hey, if my moronic brother can do it, then I probably could too. You know. But that said, I say that half jokingly, but I remember visiting the sets of his movies and seeing the directors working with the actors, and seeing them how they talk to the actors. And at the time, I was a theater director and an actor myself. And I remember thinking, my God, these guys know what the hell they're doing. Like, they're great with the camera, but when it comes to telling the actors anything, these actors are like lost at sea. And you know, and I remember seeing Remy Harlan trying to direct comedy in the movie Ford Fairlane, and it was just the most dull, torpid movie set I'd ever been on. And I thought, this is going to be the least funny comedy I've ever seen. And the script was hilarious, too.
And listen, it came off as one of the least. I remember watching Adventures of Ford Fairlane when I was a kid. And, I mean, for a kid, when you're 14, I should love this shit. This is for me.
Yeah.
This is R-rated, Andrew Dice Clay. And it's no offense to Rennie Harlan, who's done good work, but for
he's
a comedy.
He's a great director.
But for a comedy, I don't know if that's...
No, But anyway, I was inspired. I remember saying to myself, if I can learn about these cranes and crap, you know, I could come down here and I could totally do this. And then that was one of the things that kind of inspired me, I guess, when I was up in San Francisco working in theater. And I said, okay, I can you know, do this if I put my mind to it. And then I did put my mind to it and kind of learned about the cameras and cranes and crap and it eventually was able to come down and carve my own way.
Yeah. Now, Daniel, of course, is the writer of Vampire Academy, which is one of the things we're on here to promote. Now, Daniel had that movie that came out in theaters 7 years. So was this a way to get you back, to get him back involved in the business? Did you reach out to him? Did the studio want him? How did that come about that you guys got to work together on this?
Well, I mean, actually, the interesting thing about Danny is that he really wanted to direct himself, and so he kind of put his screenwriting career on hold. He wrote a couple screenplays for things he wanted to direct, but you learn when you're a screenwriter that you pretty much, if you want to direct something yourself, you have to kind of defer your salary and say, you know, give me a shot to direct. He directed a couple movies. One was called Happy Campers, one was called Sex and Death 101. And Sex and Death 101 was actually, like, you know, a pretty good movie, too.
No,
and,
I like it. Winona Ryder, yeah. Simon Baker, Patton Oswalt in it. Yeah, I like it.
But he, and so he, you know, in a weird way, he was still working, but he was just working hard and trying to direct. And then, you know, when neither of those movies got critical acclaim or commercial buzz, you know, he basically said, okay, I'm going to focus on writing again. And, you know, the producers of this, Don Murphy and Susan Montford, you know, Don Murphy's just produced all kinds of cool things like Natural Born Killers and From Hell, and he's, you know, he's kind of worked with a lot of interesting directors. He's been friends with both of us, and he basically just, you know, said, he got the rights to the books from this guy, Michael Prager. They shared the rights, and they said, okay, we're going to, and they just reached out to Danny saying, look, we're going to pay you out of our own pockets to create a screenplay for Vampire Academy. And Danny read the whole series, and he thought it was really cool, and he said, yeah, whatever, I'm not doing much else. So he jumped on and wrote the screenplay. Meanwhile, like, Don kind of secretively, stealthily told me, like, look, I want to send you this book I want you to read. He sent me Vampire Academy, and I read it, and I said, this is pretty cool. I'm kind of a little dubious about, you know, Twilight fatigue and blah, blah, blah. And he said, but, you know, I said, look, I have your brother writing a screenplay. So I was immediately more intrigued. It was almost like he kind of did a bait and switch, because Danny and I had always wanted to work together but never found the right opportunity before. And then suddenly, you know, he was writing a screenplay for this book that I thought was pretty cool. And then the screenplay came in great. I mean, it was so much, it was basically my brother's kind of vernacular and his sensibility, but put into this kind of this you know, thriller story that set at the vampire school. And I was even more intrigued and said, okay, you know, I'm going to jump on and do this as my next movie. And then, you know, it came together very quickly at that point. We got financing from Reliance, the big Indian company, and Deepak Nayar was another producer who came on. And we, pretty soon I was scouting locations all around, we were scouting locations around Massachusetts, and then all around Europe, around Czechoslovakia and all of England. We ended up shooting the movie. We found a location that was about an hour out of London, this school called Charterhouse School, and we were shooting there within a matter of months, actually. But you know, the collaboration with Danny was surprisingly good. I mean, I think we actually argue more as brothers than we ever did as collaborators. I mean, we got along surprisingly well when it came time to get down to business and do the work.
Well, my theory, and correct me if you think I'm crazy on this, but do you think you come on this list, and maybe you're at the top of the list when they ask you to direct this, but do you think it has to do with the fact that you did Freaky Friday, Mean Girls, and the Spiderwick Chronicles? Do you think that plays a role into, okay, Mark can take a movie like Vampire Academy here and bring that edge that he brought to those other three movies? We know he could do Dark, Spiderwick Chronicles. We know he could do High School, Mean Girls, and Freaky Friday. So maybe they thought you could put that all together. Is that crazy to think?
No. I think that these were all thoughts that went through their brains when they were trying to get me involved. And the movie, as you know by now, didn't really perform at the box office. And but at the same time, I'm happy with how the movie came out. I think I'm really pleased and thought it, you know, kind of captured what was cool about the Rochelle Meade book and what was cool about my brother's screenplay. Zoe Deutsch was kind of amazing casting as Rose Hathaway. And, I'm pretty psyched with how the movie came out. I hope people do end up discovering it now that it's coming out on home video.
Well, I think this is the perfect market for it, and I'm not just saying that, and I'm sure you've probably heard this from Harvey Weinstein, who's the distributor of the film, or other people, where on video on demand, where high school girls are sitting at home, and I mean, I know my sister does this. They'll look for movies on there, and I'm telling you, this is going to be at the top of the list. I think this is going to do really, really well with those people once it hits on video on demand.
Your lips to God's ears, brother.
I'm telling you. Let me ask you, it was the 10th anniversary of Mean Girls. And first of all, I basically have past, present, and future question, one of each about Lindsay Lohan. But I also have for you, I wanted to talk about this phenomenon of Mean Girls, man. It's a great movie. But, man, I never thought. I mean, no offense. I'm wondering if you ever thought this, Mark. Would it take off like the way it took off?
No, not at all. I mean, we felt like we were getting away with something making the movie because the movie didn't cost much money. It cost only around $20 million being made for Paramount. You know, in studio movie budgets, that's super low, you know. And remember, they had other really monstrous movies they were making at the time that were, you know, taking up all their attention. And we were just this tiny movie that was shooting up in Toronto, and nobody really paid attention to us. And there was really nobody in it. I mean, Tina Fey was, you know, the Weekend Update lady on SNL, and right. Lindsay had been in Freaky Friday that I made, you know, but Freaky Friday had just come out when we were casting the movie. So, you know, it's kind of success. What helped her certainly and helped the movie. But it wasn't like Lindsay Lohan was a household name yet. And,
no.
You know, and then there's all the people from the SNL cast. So we were just like sneaking in there, making this really cool, subversive, fun script, and pleased that nobody was really messing around with us. And Lauren, you know, probably visited the set two or three times, and he would take us all to dinner. And he wasn't up in our grill at all. He was just happy with the dailies and happy with how things were going. And so, you know, we all the way through, you know, editing the movie. Even I remember the head of the studio at the time, Sherry Lansing, saw the cut of the movie. And it wasn't like it was testing you that well, even.
Right.
You know, people didn't know how to take it because it was had such a weird balancing of tones. So it wasn't the kind of movie that did great in test previews. But Sherry Lansing, to her credit, said, "I love this movie. This thing, you guys don't have to change a thing, and we know how to sell it." And lo and behold, she wasn't lying. You know, they went out there and they. I remember we were even going into opening weekend. We thought it was tracking to do like $10 or $12 million opening weekend, and ended up doing 25.
Sure.
So,
yeah,
that's
huge. And Sherry Lansing, for those that don't know, she was the head at Paramount, and she was amazing. She's amazing as a person. It kind of blows my mind because in my mind I'm thinking, did Billy Friedkin see Mean Girls? That's what I want to know.
I bet he has. Yeah.
Did he love it?
I've met him a couple times, actually, and he's, you know, he definitely is a fan, so that's great. It's a weird thing where you know, as opposed to kind of getting deposited back to like, oh, this is a interesting early 21st century movie, every crop of girls, as they come of age, discovers the movie and kind of loves it. You know, I remember Zoe Deutsch, you know, and from Vampire Academy, she and Sarah Hyland, they like talked about how, you know, they saw the movie and they were kids, you know, when they saw the movie, yet it made this huge impression on them, and they discovered it on video, and then they can quote pretty much every line in the movie. Then I talked to, you know, friends of mine who have daughters who are in high school, same thing right now, they're high school now, they love it. I have an 11-year-old daughter and she goes to middle school. And she was, you know, she was saying, like, she went to school on, last Wednesday, and everybody was wearing pink, and she was being treated like royalty because she was the daughter of the director, you know. But the fact that, like, everybody was in this middle school, ages, you know, 11 through 13, whatever, they all were huge fans as well. That was definitely not what we expected, but I kind of like that it's become a little bit of an iconic touchstone. It's definitely surprising but cool.
Yeah, and let me ask you about the two fan bases that like this movie. I would say 80 to 90% of the people really get the message of the movie, and they realize it's a movie about acceptance, and it's a movie about maturity, and it's a movie about all these great things. Then I'd say there's 10% of this audience, and I don't know if you're aware of this audience. But there's a 10% of this audience, and maybe you do because of the daughters and everyone you know, that want to be the plastics and live this lifestyle that they're like, you can't sit at this table. And you're probably shocked that this 30-year-old man knows all this Mean Girl stuff, but I know. And I loved it when it came out. I'll tell you what. What is your reaction, though, to the people that don't get the message of the film?
Right, who treat it like an instructional video as opposed to a like this is a PSA on how to be a plastic. Yeah, that's disturbing. You know,
have you heard about that though, or is that something that hasn't made?
Well, certainly it's something where like, you know, people dress up for Halloween as the plastic,
right.
which I think is okay, because that's maybe poking fun of it.
Sure.
I mean, the great thing is that we're living in a different age now, 10 years later, where, you know, bullying is not kind of something that's swept under the rug anymore. I mean, even, you know, certainly when I went through high school, it was like, you know, it was very, very prominent. Nobody gave a, you know, a rat's ass about whether you were getting beat up at school. It was not talked about. And then it became talked about, and now it's become a thing where the cool kids are the nerds, you know, and it's no longer, we no longer live in a world where it's tacitly accepted that you're going to get bullied in school. Because, you know, people, and I think, you know, hopefully the movie has had some part in making that part of the cultural awareness. And so, you know, and I think we definitely have progressed, and I feel like, you know, my kid's school was really good about that stuff. And, we've turned a corner.
I think people that get the message understand that if those girls kept going about doing what they were doing as the plastics, they were going to be 30 single and very lonely and very broke. Or they were going to marry some guy for his money, and that wasn't going to work out too well. I think people that are smart realize that it's the people that – and this is why I always say to kids that – I mean, I've gotten emails from like 16, 15-year-old gay kids from doing stuff on the show – who've told me they've been bullied. And I remember the first one I got, like, blew my mind. I'm like, why the hell are they coming to me? I don't want to talk about this. This is too much for me to handle. But my whole thought was always, listen, it's the kids that got bullied in school that turn out really successful later in life. Just keep a positive attitude and keep moving forward. And I think if people take that message from your movie, I do think it sends a really positive message, and it's a great movie, Mean Girls, and I'm glad after 10 years, it's still just as big as it was.
Yeah. I mean, one of the messages in the movie that I think is important, too, that was important for me to get across, is to give people the sense that, you know, high school is finite. It ends, you know, and even after all the turmoil of their junior year, by senior year, everybody's kind of like chained cliques. You know, and they're worrying about different things. But when you're in the middle of it, you can't see. You have blinders on. When you're young, you don't realize that, like, you know, that all the problems that are crushing you are not going to crush you forever. You know, and then there is an escape, and escape will eventually happen just through time. And I think if you can give that kind of peace of mind that, you know, just by keeping your head down and surviving, you're eventually going to get to a better place. I think that's something that's hopefully a positive message within there too.
So the before, present, and after questions I have about Mean Girls relating to Lindsay Lohan is, when you were doing Freaky Friday and you said it hadn't even come out yet, I'm sure it was testing well. How did you choose her for Mean Girls? Was it from working with her with Freaky Friday, or was it a coincidence that they teamed you guys up again?
Oh, no, it was definitely, you know, I was definitely involved in that. I mean, it was something where they came after me as a director for it. And when I just really, like, you know, read the screenplay and thought to myself, the last thing I possibly want to do is another movie set around the high school where I hear locker doors slamming when we call background action, you know, and I wanted to shoot myself. But then the script was so good, I couldn't ignore it. And you know, and when I kind of raised my hand saying I wanted to do it, Sherry Lansing demanded to see Breaking Friday, and she saw it and thought, oh my God, not only is Mark perfect for this, but this girl is amazing. You know, we should get Lindsay too. You know, but the interesting thing is at the time, I told Sherry, like, look, Lindsay's perfect for Regina George. Like, she is superb. She's so strong. Such a big personality. She would love this. And I gave the screenplay to Lindsay. Lindsay also said, oh, my God, I can't wait to play Regina. Like, this is going to be amazing. Like, this is such a great part. I'm dying to do this. And but then we proceeded to try to find somebody to play Katie. And nobody was good enough. Nobody was strong enough.
They could
dominate Lindsay, you
did
know.
Mark, did you ever try switching with Rachel McAdams as Katie? Was that ever an option?
Well, interesting enough, during this time period, Rachel McAdams came in and read for Katie, and she gave an amazing reading. And actually, I take credit for this because I remember I told her this in the room. I said, you know, I think you are a movie star, and I think you're too old to be playing Katie. You're not right for that. I think she was 23 or 24 at the time, and she just didn't seem right as like the ingenue anymore. You know, I said you're really amazing to watch. And it's too bad this is not right for you. But then over time we said, okay, what if, you know, and Sherry Lansing had to kind of sit me down and give me a come to Jesus speech to say, look, like Freaky Friday has become a really big hit. You know, people love Lindsay. We just have to bite the bullet, and you're going to have to make her work as Katie as the lead. You know, and I said, yeah, okay, let's do it. And then we proceeded to try to find Regina, and that's when we brought Rachel back into the mix. And she broke out her blonde wig from The Notebook and came in to test against Lindsay. And the interesting thing is that the person who came in number two in our testing for playing Regina George was none other than Amanda Seyfried.
Yeah, right.
Who was amazing as Regina. She played it kind of like in this cool, spooky, Machiavellian way. It was very different than the way that Rachel played, but also really interesting, and we loved her. But there was something about Rachel and Lindsay where, because Rachel's a bit older and very, very composed, Lindsay was kind of intimidated around her in the room. And so just that feeling I had of almost before they started to read, of Lindsay being a little bit, you know, kind of in awe of Rachel, or just kind of like, you know, she's a little bit taken aback by her. Okay, I thought that's going to be perfect. And so, and then Lorne Michaels, I think, was the one who had the inspiration later, because we were about to cast another actress who's become quite well known. I'm not going to say her name, but basically she, for the role that Amanda ended up playing for Karen. But then Lauren said to me one day, you know, what about the dumb girl? You know, you think Amanda Seyfried could play the dumb girl? And so we brought her back in again, and we read her as Karen, and she was genius. And that was, that was kind of historic for her, because she'd never really done anything except for like a guest spot on a soap opera. And
right.
So this is really her first movie. And then she's gone on to become quite a star herself, you know?
I got to tell you, in 190 episodes of this show, that is the best description I've ever heard of the casting process in Hollywood. So I appreciate that. That was really good. No, it was really detailed and really good. I'm really happy with that. That was great for me. Let me ask you then about the present here, where it's what happened during Mean Girls? Did anything happen at all that you could tell Lindsay was going in a different direction? The reason I ask you this question is, one, you guys didn't work together again after this, and that could be just pure coincidence, not the right project. That happens all the time. But was there anything you could sense that she was having troubles at that time?
She wasn't having troubles, per se. I mean, she was still quite young. Remember, she was a minor at the time. And she was 16 years old when she did Freaky Friday. She was 17 when we did Mean Girls. I think the difference was really in her kind of supervision. I mean, when she did Freaky Friday, her parents were there. Her mother was on set every day. She had, you know, her family, her younger siblings were with her. She was a minor, and she really was a minor. I mean, she would go to school, and when we weren't shooting her, we had very limitations of hours that we could use. We work with her. When we got around to Mean Girls, it had changed to the point where she didn't have her family around. Instead, she had a 21-year-old assistant who was acting as her guardian. And suddenly it was no longer like she was a kid. I mean, she was somebody who basically wanted to go out and party in Toronto when she wasn't shooting. We still had to kind of get her wrapped by a certain time. We still had to obey the minor's hours, but she was no longer kind of living the life of a kid. You know, instead she was like, you have to wrap me because I've reached my hours. But then the moment she wrapped, she would be like getting dressed to go out to the club.
That's what we call having your cake and eating it too. Both, it's the best of both worlds.
I remember vividly, like having, you know, when we were, you know, we rushed to get her wrapped by her minor's hours, and then, you know, and then we were doing like night shooting, like trying to get some like pickup shots, and we drove past her, you know, kind of like out, clubbing. It's really, she's waving to us. Hey, we're like, yay, our whistle working. But she, the fact is, when she was on set, she had a great work ethic, you know, which,
yeah,
was,
sure.
And, you know, she was still very, very talented. And, you know, when she was actually, you know, kind of on her mark and in front of me, she was just really easy to work with and then very, very, you know, kind of quick to respond to direction. And, you know, but I could see that she definitely was a kid who had been robbed of her childhood and was excited to go out and play, you know, and was excited that she didn't have supervision and she could kind of party a little bit. But, you know, but then again, you know, I did crazy, stupid stuff, you know. The TMZ was not waiting outside my dorm room my freshman year of college. If so, it would have been incredibly embarrassing for me, you know. So the thing is, she went through all that stuff, but she hasn't broken out of it, though, and that's the sad thing.
I hear that, and I get it, and that's the reason people give all the time. And by the way, it's a very legitimate reason. You can look at Bieber and say the same thing and why he acts the way he acts. But then how do you explain guys like Justin Timberlake and like Rachel McAdams, who you worked with on Mean Girls, who were also young, maybe not as young as – well, Justin was, but Rachel wasn't as young as Lindsay, I don't think, when she started. But these are young people that didn't really have as those kind of problems. What's the difference?
I don't want to cast stones, but it's obviously the parents. You know, I mean, you think about it, like you come from a certain kind of family and a certain kind of, you know, supervision and, you know, in your life, you know, you behave a different way. And clearly that was not something that was kind of imposed on her or, you know, kind of instilled in her in a way that was going to be helpful for the rest of her life, you know. And there's many cases of people who go from being child stars to being successful. Natalie Portman, you know, I'm sure she's got a great support from her family, you know, and she ends up getting a degree from Yale, I think, right? I mean, or Harvard, I'm not sure. But even so, you know, it's not like it's not doable. It's just hard. The temptations are there. And unless you have somebody to really kind of steer you to the path of righteousness, it's very easy to go astray.
No, that's true. For every Natalie Portman, you got two Macaulay Culkins. That's absolutely true.
He's a great kid.
No, I mean, it's just true. And it's the sad thing about the business. Listen, every director friend I talk to in the business, and I'm betting Mark will agree and say the same thing, you would never let your daughter be a child actor, would you? I don't know,
you know,
any director who's like, yeah, I'll put you in a movie. Like, they don't want their kids in the movie.
they could be in my movie, but, you know, my biggest fear with kids is that, you know, I just don't want them to have to audition for things. I can't imagine putting your kids in a position where they're sitting on plastic folding chairs auditioning against 20 other kids and most of the time not getting the part.
Right.
Like, you know, the idea of kind of putting your kids through that planned rejection, I just couldn't imagine doing that, and luckily we're in a financial position where we don't have to rely on our kids to make money for us, you know, which I think a lot of these families have that problem where they're, you know, using the kid as their magic pony to make money for them.
No, I'm about at that point with my nephew. I'm just going to put him to work. He's two. I'm just going to put him out in Hollywood. Make me some fucking money. I was talking to an actor today who did their first audition, and like I saw the audition tape, and it was for a big movie that's coming out. I won't say which one, and I'm like, you know, it's okay. But I got to tell you something. Don't be deterred by me saying it's okay. You're going to literally have to audition 100 times before you get a role. And it's not because of your talent. That's just the odds. The odds are you will have to hear no 100 times before someone says, yeah, I'm going to put you in a movie.
Yeah.
I mean, that's fair, right? That's fair.
And then you're lucky. You're lucky if you
and
get
lucky.
It. Yeah.
Right. You're lucky if you get in one after 100. I remember this TV show I'm doing now with LD Entertainment. I mean, I probably got told I would send a million scripts out around town. And I would get you've probably had this, Mark. I'm sure Daniel has, your brother, where you get notes back and people say, oh, this is really good, and it just never ends up getting made, or some production companies don't like it, whatever. And then you finally hear yes, and then that's where you're like, I'm the luckiest son of a bitch alive. Let's ride this hot streak. I mean, that's just how it happens. You're going to have to fail a million times before you succeed in this business.
Yeah, well, all you care about is getting one yes. You know,
right.
You don't need more than one. If you get the one yes you need, it's kind of like the method of dating that a lot of men take, which is they're just going to hit on everybody, ask everybody for their phone number, and eventually there's going to be some woman who's stupid enough to give it to them.
It's true.
But I admire guys like that. I've never been one of them, but I'm impressed with men who have that attitude.
There's two other actors I want to ask you about who you've worked with, and there's one who I think is up and coming, kind of undiscovered in a way, and I want to know how you feel about her. And then the other one is, when you were doing Ghost of Girlfriends Past with McConaughey, I remember I saw Lincoln Lawyer a little bit after this or a little before that. I don't know which came out first.
It was after it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Lincoln Lawyer came out after him.
Okay, I remember I saw Ghost, and then I saw Lincoln Lawyer. And it was back-to-back for me. And I'm like, all right, this guy, if he just does projects that are this good, forget Dallas Buyers Club. I wasn't even thinking like that. But I'm like, if this guy does projects that are this good, he's gonna be an Academy Award, at least nominated actor. Now, did you see that in him when you were working with him with Ghost? Because people thought I was crazy, Mark. People thought I was fucking Looney Tunes when I said that.
Well, I first of all, I love the fact that you like Ghost of Girlfriends Past that
I
much.
Do.
I'm very fond of that movie too. And but working with Matthew was great because Matthew is this kind of like surprisingly egoless actor. And, you know, obviously this guy's not lacking in confidence in real life. But as an actor, he has no kind of resistance to doing what you ask of him. And sometimes making a fool of himself, you know. And I liken him to a football player, you know, where he's a guy who wants to please the coach, you know. And I'm the coach. And he's like, give me the ball. Tell me what you want to do. And he goes for it, and he's got a real athletic sensibility as well. I mean, he is an athlete, and it's something about him that is like he really responds to that well. But he was great. He was great to work. I mean, I remember just like finding it so easy to edit his material in that movie, having this kind of like plethora of good choices, which you often don't have with your lead actor. You're often kind of like scrounging around trying to find the one decent take. And with him, it was like, oh, no, I got a lot of great choices, you know, and he's got, you know, so much natural charisma. You know, I love the fact that he, you know, really decided to take a break about material and say, I get sent this kind of material, I get sent scripts like Fool's Gold, you know, and instead of saying yes because I'm getting an awful lot of money for it, I'm going to take a pause and wait until the good material comes to me again. And eventually it did, and he chose very wisely. And, you know, and then because he's got the skills, you know, when he got his shot again, he delivered, you know. And, I mean, I think if people had never seen Matthew McConaughey, never seen The Wedding Planner or whatever, and just had seen Dallas Buyers Club as the first thing, you would be talking about the guy like he was Robert De Niro.
Right.
You know, it's like he's that good in the movie, and he's that good in the other movies he's done, you know, in the past few years, like Mud and Killer Joe. I mean, and True Detective. I mean, he's just been doing great work, setting them up and knocking them down. So.
No, that's right, and that's why I wanted to go with LD Entertainment for the pilot I'm doing because of Killer Joe. I fucking love that movie. I thought it was amazing.
Cool. That's a fantastic movie.
That's when I said Mickey Lydell, he's the perfect guy to work with because he took a risk on this Billy Friedkin movie that's NC-17. You got McConaughey playing not McConaughey at all. You got Gina Gershon sucking down on chicken legs. And, I mean, that's all you got to say about that movie. It's crazy, and it's great. Ghost of Girlfriends Past, I'm going to tell you, first of all, I saw it at like noon opening day. This is how much I was anticipating this movie of yours. But like legit, ever since I would say, I mean, I loved House of Yes, but ever since Freaky Friday, been a huge fan of your work. So I go to see Ghost of Girlfriends Past, and here's what I really dug about it. One, there's a lot of complexity that's not in a lot of romantic comedies. Two, the comedy's good. But here's the third thing. how did you know Michael Douglas would kill that so well? Like, he kills that role.
Oh, yeah. I mean, wait, how would you think Michael Douglas wouldn't kill that role?
I guess that's so true. Michael just, yeah, I mean, it's a role made for Nicholson more so, right? Or Warren Beatty. We know about Douglas's personal life if you lived out in Hollywood and you were around in the 90s and the early 2000s, like my friends were and like you were. So we know he had kind of that swinging lifestyle. Now,
yeah, or 70s and 80s, But he knows all those guys, and frankly, you know, not to be crude about it, but he got as much tail as all of them, you know? And he's like, I was just amazed that he read the script and loved it, you know, as much as he did. His first question to me when we talked was saying that, like, so wait, you're married, and Matthew's, like, you know, got a serious girlfriend, and the producer married. Like, who's going to take advantage of, you know, of this bounty of casting, this bonanza of hot women? And none of us. This is ridiculous. he was so annoyed that everybody, including himself, were married, and nobody was going to be like doing the casting couch, you know. But he was in character, wasn't he? He came in the day we did that scene at the bar where he counsels the young Connor. You know, he came in and did like 8 pages of dialogue straight through. He didn't miss a comma, you know, for every take we did. He was so in the zone with that part.
My other actor I want to ask you about, who I think is a great actress, and I don't really know why she's not getting the kind of work she's getting, who you worked with on your TV show, Witches of East End, is Jenna Dewan Tatum. I think she could be, like, a real big breakout. And, of course, that's Channing Tatum's wife, for people that don't know. But she's amazing. Do you think it kind of holds her back a little that she's Channing's wife? I've always speculated that. Like, people, like Hollywood, the machine, may not want to get behind it.
No, I don't think that's an issue so much. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's really just her time. You know, I think she's somebody when she was younger, she was kind of like, you know, there's something that's almost too green about her as the ingenue. She needed to become a real woman, you know, and not as yet she had a baby as well. And I think, I'm not sure how old she is, I think she's around 30. But, like, I think she's kind of matured in the age where she's in the zone where she should be working, you know. But she's got, I remember she actually had auditioned for me for another pilot I did, the so-called Maiden Jersey. And I remember thinking, like, she didn't get it, but she really impressed me, and she stuck with me, and we were kind of like, you know, we were really at a tough time casting that part in Witches of East End. But she came, you know, we kind of started to discuss her. She just she came in and wowed everybody. You know, she's got an immense amount of charm about her, for sure. You know, I mean, obviously she's a looker, but she's really got this, like, you know, she comes in a room and really lights it up. So. You know,
yeah,
I'm hoping she takes off from there too. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, she had the baby last, you know, kind of, you know, before doing the first season. Now she's, you know, they're shooting the second season. But I think, you know, I think she's going to get movie offers, you know, for her hiatus this year, hopefully.
I hope so. Let me ask you about Watermark Pictures.
Hey, I gotta warn you quickly that I gotta give my youngest daughter a bath.
No, that's fine. This
you
is
know,
my last.
Maybe one or two more questions.
No, this is it for you. This is my last one for you. I want to ask you about your production company and what you guys got going on in development. What we can expect.
We know we're Jessica Dushinsky, who used to be my agent at CAA, became my partner. We produced 500 Days of Summer. And we have a few things going. There's two movie projects. One is called SOS. It's based on a Korean film that was called Castaway on the Moon. We got Adam Scott and Isla Fisher attached to it, and we're it's hard to pitch it except for the fact that it's about a disgraced Wall Street trader who tries to kill himself by jumping off a bridge in Manhattan. But then he washes up on the shore of an island, and he wakes up and realizes he's on an island in the middle of the East River. This is called Mill Rock Island, and nobody notices him there. And he thinks, okay, maybe I should try to swim back to shore. But he realizes he has nothing to swim back to. You know, that he was about to kill himself, So he just ends up staying on this island, carving out like a Tom Hanks from Castaway existence, you know, on his own. Meanwhile, there's a woman who's a claustrophobic food blogger who lives in her room and never leaves her room in a building across the way. And she kind of sees this guy and becomes intrigued by him. And they end up having, you know, without kind of blowing anything, they end up having this really weird slow burn relationship that they develop with each other. These kind of two people are both kind of screwed up in their own ways, and they end up kind of, you know, saving each other. It's a really, really cool romantic comedy. And then there's another thing called Rope Trick, which is a black kind of noir comedy written by this guy, Steve Sutton. And, you know, the cast that I want to talk about, because we have some casting attached, but I don't want to mention it yet. But that's another thing that's set up. We have financing, and we might be making that in the next year. And then there's a couple things we're producing, too. We're producing a TV show called Sovereign Soul with Jeff Stansler is the creator, and Jason Patrick is going to be the lead on that. The
awesome.
Limited series is going to shoot in New York this summer. And Jason Patrick, this is an amazing role. It's kind of like Damian Lewis in Homeland. It's a really interesting role. And then, we're also going to, we got a number of other things. We're going to produce a adaptation of John Green's novel, Looking for Alaska, something he wrote before he wrote Fault in Our Stars. And then we're hoping to get that set up, too.
Well, that's great. Go be a parent, Mark. Vampire Academy, it's out on Blu-ray, DVD, and video on demand on May 20th. You can download it on iTunes, Amazon, Comcast, all those things. It's also Blu-ray, DVD. You could check all your stores for that. Thank you so much, Mark, for joining us. You're a great interviewer. I hope you come do the show again.
All right, man. Take care.
Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Some people got to go be a parent.
Yeah.
Whatever. They don't have our lives, our sweet, sassy, molassy lives.
Well, here in the...
Sometimes I wonder when I say sweet, sassy, molassy, if it's, like, racist, and I don't know.
I think it's in one of those comments, it's only racist if you think it's racist.
Right.
Or you bring it up.
There's a lot of those, right?
Yeah, right.
Like, one time I said... I say this all the time, too. I say crazier than a pet coon, and people think that's racist. They're like, you just shouldn't say it.
Here's my answer to that.
Yeah.
You're actually more racist for thinking it's racist.
That's what
than
I think.
Am.
That's what I think. Why is race on your mind all the time? Okay. Well, whatever. I want to talk about some things.
He was good.
He was great. He was great. Vampire Academy, great.
I got to throw this out here. First off, Mean Girls is probably one of the first women. I mean, I guess you could say it's, you know, unisex, but realistically, it's a chick flick.
Sure.
Okay,
it's like a John Hughes chick flick,
exactly. But it was one of the first movies, I'm sure for all of us, that, you know, growing up, you watch a movie, you're like, this movie's it's just great. It doesn't matter, guy, girl, whatever. It was a great film.
It was universally a good film, right?
But wow, they are crazy.
I watched it. I watched it, it was a Sunday, it was on, you know, nobody was home, so I didn't have to explain to my dad while I was watching.
And you're shocked you like it, right?
No, I still like it.
But you're shocked you did the first time you watched it, right?
Because I remember...
I'm sitting there, I'm like...
I'll never forget the first time I watched it. I was sitting at my buddy's house, and it was like a bro haven. Like, you know, it was like, you know, one of those houses. It was like 7 21-year-old dudes.
Right. Everyone rented
a house. And, you know, it's just like testosterone. And my buddy's like, dude, you got to watch Mean Girls. I'm like, excuse me? You know, and I look at the cover, and I see the plastic in the front. I'm like, Lindsay Lohan. I'm like, dude, really? Are you fucking kidding me?
It's all pink.
I'm like, you know.
Well, you know what's funny about that movie is? This was 2004, so I hated SNL by then. Hated it.
Yeah,
I hate it today.
That was the end.
Yeah, SNL died in like 1999.
Tina Fey was nothing to me but this woman I would see every now and then on entertainment clip shows, and she just came off as annoying in little clips.
Yeah,
you know? And I ended up loving her. I love 30 Rock. She's great.
Right, and who the hell is Rachel McAdams?
Right, who's Rachel McAdams?
Yeah.
Lindsay Lohan, well, that's nice, but, you know, Freaky Friday's good and all, but what's the other thing she did? Trap?
It's no Mean Girls.
Yeah, what did she do, Parent Trap 10 years before that or whatever? So, you know, I'm like, all right, Lindsay Lohan, whatever. Oh, Tim Meadows is in it.
Neil Flynn?
Yeah, Neil Flynn. Yeah. Oh, that's cute. Lizzie Kaplan's in it. Oh, that's cute. And then you watch it, and you're like, this is really fucking good. Because it's edgy. It's edgy. Pat Tobias sent me a note during the interview. It was rated R at one point. They had to cut stuff out to make it PG-13.
Yeah, well, that could have been why I liked it.
Yeah, it's edgy.
But all right, what my original point was is when I watched it like a month ago on Sunday, and I watched the beginning to end, I realized something when I was watching it. Like, First off, it blows my mind that it's been 10 years since the movie came out.
Crazy, right?
It scares the hell out of me.
First of all, makes you feel old, makes me feel
old.
Yeah,
right.
Makes him feel like a dad.
So my point being is that
yes.
How much it's changed technology-wise, everything. There was no Facebook. There was no Twitter.
No.
They didn't even text message
texting.
Each other.
No.
I mean, it just, like...
Could you imagine if they made that movie in a stuff to involve Instagram, somehow involves some Twitter. Also, it's not a realistic
there
movie.
There was a great article where somebody literally dissected the entire Mean Girls movie. Said, this is what would the plastics and everybody in Mean Girls would be in 2014.
Today, right.
Yeah.
It's funny you bring that up. I dated an 18-year-old... a while ago, but we were talking about it, and I'm like, you just graduated from high school. Now, this story already sounds creepy. I already sound like Bryan Singer, but whatever. I don't really care.
Yeah, the difference was this was 5 years ago.
Yeah, right. This is
it's not a community college. It's a high school.
No, this was a few years ago, but this was relatable, though. This is relatable. This was right after Snapchat came out, so this isn't that long ago. Yeah, maybe like a year ago. Listen, I'm going to sound like a scumbag, but I might as well just let it all rip right now. Listen, hey, here's the difference, Singer. She's legal. 18 is legal.
And she's a woman.
I've never shit on 18. I've only shit on Singer and those guys for 16, 15, 14. And the other thing I shit on them for is making promises and, like, ruining people's lives.
All right, I don't
So that's my defense.
Yeah.
That's my defense. I know, but here's what's going to happen.
Next.
I get 50 emails that say, you rip on Bryan Singer all the time, but you date 18-year-old girls. That's not the point. You missed the point entirely.
They're women. They're not girls.
So anyways, 18-year-old. And I go, you just graduated high school. Day like in high school for you with all this social media. And you go, the two most popular apps are
Snapchat
and Instagram.
You would think apps.
Facebook's third. Facebook is kind of like the gossip central, okay? People are always on Facebook checking statuses, talking shit, all that kind of stuff. It's like the gossip hub.
Facebook makes it official.
But gossip now comes in second to high school next to vanity. Vanity comes in first. Pictures.
Selfies.
It's girls taking pictures of their cleavage going, look at my new necklace, because they just grew boobs and they want the whole world to know about it. And then they snap it out to the whole school because they got a nice little cross hanging from their tits. You know, so that's what I found out. All the drama now happens on Snapchat, Instagram, and Facebook. There's kids coming out of the closet on Instagram. This girl goes, my best friend, who's a gay guy, he came out on Instagram. He just posted a picture, hashtag, I'm gay. I'm like, what's this world coming to? I'll give you another example. Whenever I've dated anyone under the age of 24 in the last 2 years, 3 years, they don't talk on the phone.
No. Nobody
talks. Refuse. I call you. You call me.
Yeah, we talk.
I call you. You call me. I call Steve Weirich. I'm on my phone all day. The only time we're texting is when it's meaningless bullshit in our big group text messages, like here's a memmy or here's
like my photo of the
or
you
like
know,
when you
this is my love
five
life
guys
yeah.
and be like, hey, I'm booking the movie for Friday. What time we doing?
Which, right. By the way, Mr. Kanata is still not.
I'm the only one that's confirmed.
He apparently might be out of town for work, but he doesn't know yet.
I'm not sure.
So
yet.
He's out.
Well, I told you a week ago.
I travel for work. What do you
I'm good.
Know?
I'm good for my work.
So my point being is that I hope. And since I know Lenny's not listening, he's gonna miss this too. I'm buying the tickets when we get off the radio show. And so far, it's gonna be two.
He's looking at his watch. That he doesn't
it might as well be two. We will go to the Studio Grill. We'll eat again.
Yeah, right.
I'll eat the Godzilla burger. I'm sure they'll have one.
Yeah.
Or I'll just get three patties.
No, they'll have the Godzilla margarita.
Yeah, that's true. They will.
Oh, yeah.
And let's talk about Spider-Man in a minute too. But I wanted to bring up how girls just don't talk on the phone anymore. And I'm sure guys don't either.
Nobody talks on the
guys
phone
anymore. Guys and girls under the age of, what's the age? You've probably noticed this with Danny, your brother. They don't talk on the fucking phone. Do you ever see Danny
20,
on 20, the phone?
24 and younger right now.
Let me ask you, do you ever see Danny on the phone?
No.
Never on it.
Texting all the time.
See, that blows my mind. Because
they don't talk.
Because when
how do you set things up? How do you
care?
How do you think?
I just got into a fight with my brother-in-law through texting. Because you lose that ability to sense sarcasm, to
emotions.
There's nothing there. It's just so cold and dry.
If you say, hey, fuckface, and then text it, or then say it, it's...
It blows my fucking mind.
I mean, the only way you can get away with it, and even this time, it's not foolproof. If you, like us, we really know each other really well,
yeah,
we can kind of feel it out. But you still don't know.
Okay.
Like,
I'll
Anthony,
give you an
like
example.
Anthony's text.
I'll give you an example. Anthony sends an asshole text yesterday. Now, if those two fuckers would call each other, Alex and Anthony, how quickly would this situation been put out of fire? Oh, Anthony was just being a dick and making a smart-ass comment. He wasn't trying to be an asshole. He was just making a smart-ass. He thought it was a funny joke.
Yeah, right.
Now, the problem is, when all you do is text, he don't know it's a smart-ass joke. He thinks he's being
right.
attacked. I think, I'm all day yesterday, I'm texting Alex. I go, what the fuck's the problem? What's going on? Lenny's calling me because Lenny and I call each other. We're calling each other back and forth going, what the fuck's going on? There's so many problems that can be solved with a phone call.
Oh, yeah.
I call everybody at work.
But here's the thing. You know why people like texting? Because there's less commitment.
It's no commitment. I don't even think it's any commitment.
That's like Instagram and all this shit. It lessens the blow of the repercussions.
Right.
So it gives people this way of trying to, like, be themselves or do what they want to do. But then if anything happens, they can try to, like, pull back a little bit, be like, oops.
They're just insecure with themselves.
I'll tell you what, whether you're dating guys or whether you're dating girls, no matter who you're dating in the world, I'm going to tell you something right now. I'm not saying they're a keeper if they do this. But if they make an effort to talk to you on the phone, because most of the girls I meet nowadays, most of anybody I meet nowadays, forget girls, just even new friends, it's on the internet. It's on the internet, whether it's guys or girls. I meet everybody on the internet now, unless we go out or I'm introduced through someone through Mikey or through Alex or through whatever. People I meet solo on the internet, Tinder, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, whatever.
Even in a professional work setting,
yeah.
I call all my vendors and all my customers. They're like, Alex, you know, you're like the only one that
Well,
calls
my new me. Rule is, and my advice
Mike,
out there for people
lot,
is,
Mike, you probably get this a lot with this
it thing. Ain't real yeah. till they call you, not text you. It ain't real till they call you. They're not your real friend. They're not your real potential boyfriend or girlfriend. They're not your potential anything unless they call you. That's
yeah.
when
well,
it's real.
When you're sitting there crafting text messages back and forth to each other and, you know, not playing the game, but you're playing the game.
Do
you
I
know
put
what I mean?
The quote in?
That whole bullshit.
I'm not going to give the whole story, but Caesar and I's communications got miscrossed this week because I didn't feel like, no, this is my fault. I didn't feel like I had the time to call Caesar. And Caesar and I were like, we had all these plans last week, but all our plans changed this week. But neither of us knew our plans changed because we text each other this, like, stupid, meaningless bullshit, and then I just don't have the time to call. When all this could have been found out last week if I made a phone call, or days ago if I made a phone call.
10-second phone call.
It's never 10 seconds with Caesar.
No.
But yes, a phone call, yes.
By the way, I want to say I watched a movie last night that I think you guys need to watch. It's
you said
filth.
Lift?
Filth.
Lift?
No, it's filth.
Filth.
But it's spelt differently, isn't it? Or is it spelt filth?
Filth.
It
filth.
Is spelt filth?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I looked it up like four times.
You
I,
did too?
Yeah,
because I did. When you posted it, I go, I never heard of lift.
Right.
Yeah. Lift.
So I looked it up. Cause
who
I,
has a speech impediment?
I tried spelling it.
He was texting you.
No, that's how it's spelled, filth.
Oh, can I tell you something? Here's another thing that blows my mind about social media. So now if you're social media and you get like 100 likes, which, by the way, ain't jack fucking shit. Len Cannata can walk around with his hand on his dick all he wants and he gets 100 likes on a comment. Just don't forget George Clooney posts the word poop on his Facebook page. He gets 6 million likes, okay? 100 likes don't mean jack diddly. So you see all these people on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, and they have like a couple hundred followers, right? And they think they're like movie stars. They do like amateur porn, and they're like, I'm a porn star. You're not a porn star. You're like the guy at McDonald's that fries the fries. And that's your only job. All you do is fry the fries.
But you tell everybody you're a chef.
Yeah, you're a porn employee. That's all you are. You're not a star.
Doorman.
The star's Ronald fucking McDonald. The star's the manager. The star's the CEO. You ain't a fucking star. You're the fry cook. That's all you are. And I'm getting so sick of these people. I think we've talked about this on this show like a million times.
I'm not friends with
these people.
I'm
getting so sick of these people.
They're all your pals.
I got to tell you, it must be because of what I do for a living that it attracts that. because I have so many people on my Instagram, Facebook who are like, I'm a fucking star. You're nobody. You're nobody. Nothing.
Yeah, I...
You're
a
speck of dust
in
the universe.
He or she is a could be.
We're all specks of dust in the universe. Get off your fucking high horse. You're nobody. That's true. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I do want to say...
Just real quick.
Yeah.
Phil, you got to see it.
Phil,
James,
that's why I was
James
saying.
McVoy or McVoy. Who was the guy? Who was that guy? He was the guy that was in the first X-Men.
James McAvoy.
Yeah.
He's great.
I'm telling you right now, of everything I've ever seen him in, this is his best role, hands down.
Really?
The movie's twisted in the best way possible.
I think he's a great actor, James McAvoy.
You watch this movie, what he does in this role, it's just, it's fantastic.
How great was Spider-Man 2?
You know what? It was so good yesterday when I was looking up movie reviews to figure out what I was going to watch.
Yeah.
When I saw that I only had 55% of Rotten Tomatoes.
I was going to ask you this question, Mike, because you didn't comment on my post. I know you agreed with my post. You liked, but you didn't comment on my post on Facebook.
I didn't realize
what I was talking about when I said people are talking shit. 55%.
I totally expected it to be, and you know what? I didn't read a ton of it, but I saw when I clicked on it, it looked like the critics were actually like close to 80%. And then it was 55 less for the people, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot the term they use. Anyway,
did you get invited to see Neighbors tonight with Carmi and Len, by the way?
No.
They're at Neighbors right now, River East. I didn't get an invite.
Did you get an invite?
I didn't get an invite.
No, because Carm's back, Len's in his mood. Carm's all to himself.
That's why Len didn't call me till like midnight last night. He was probably out with Carmi all night.
Yeah, they went out the Wednesday. Didn't you read the text message?
No, I didn't. No one invited me out Wednesday.
This was like a week ago.
No, Carmi just got in yesterday, Momo.
I know, but he said he was coming.
My point is, I didn't get an invite.
Did you get
an invite? No, because they're doing that. Glenn's little, Lem Slam piece is in from San Diego. So, he's off the mat for a couple days soaking up his vajayjay while it's around.
I wanted to see Neighbors. And I believe I asked everyone if we could go see Neighbors after Chef.
Listen.
What does this do to my Chef plans?
Listen.
Should you and I just go see Chef tomorrow and, like, if Len don't get back to me.
Listen. Here
we go.
I texted. I said, Len and Alex, let me know. Alex got back to me.
Well, Godzilla's not till next week. So you're
good. But I'm buying tickets tonight.
Right. No, because we saw Spider-Man. This is back to Spider-Man. Sold out.
Right.
The day you bought tickets.
And Godzilla's
which was
probably going to be a bigger opener than fucking...
But, I wanted to go see fucking Neighbors. So what we're doing tomorrow, Mikey? After we see Chef, you and I are going to go see Neighbors, too.
We're going to tag everybody in.
And when Lenny's pissed about it that we're seeing two movies and he already saw one, tough shenane.
No, I'm just saying, hey, listen, Carmi and Len could very easily got a hold of us.
He calls me every day otherwise. We're doing breakfast tomorrow morning.
I told you, Maddie.
It's not like I'm not seeing him in 12 hours.
I told you the other night when I was hanging out with the scumbag crew.
Yeah, right.
You know, sometimes you get some little breaths of fresh air and you realize what jagoffs our friends are.
Man.
Like, really. I'm honestly, the older I get, the more I realize how the asshole moves.
I almost don't want to have breakfast with him tomorrow. I'm going to tell you why. I don't want to hear about the movie Neighbors. I want to see it.
I
don't need a review for
listen,
him.
Listen, bring it up.
I'm
8 a.m.
Of course he's going to bring it up.
You know how you stop that? Same way like when you like to try to force like a sports team to like, start putting a winning performance in the field. You don't support it. You don't put up with it.
Yeah, right.
They fucking, it's like a dog. The dog fucks up, you know.
You give it a whack. May I say, by the way, to get back to Amazing Spider-Man 2, which Len has not seen, loser, because it's one of the best movies.
Why is it getting bad reviews?
I don't know.
The one thing I did read was something about the bad guys. They hated the bad guys.
Oh, fuck them. Fuck them.
Listen,
they did a way better job than Sam Raimi did with Spider-Man 3.
And Electro sucks. I mean, he's just a bad character.
But you know what? I thought they did a really good job with a really bad character.
No, they did about as good as you're going to get. Because it's just the character itself is weak.
Listen, here's why they did a really good job with Electro. Spider-Man had to figure out a way to beat this guy without using his superpowers. It was actually pretty sweet. Like, they didn't just have Spider-Man kill this guy. Spoiler alert. You'll watch it. But Spider-Man has to figure out a way to beat Electro that has nothing to do with being Spider-Man. It's scientific. It's kind of cool. Right? Yeah. So... I'm not going to spoil it because that's a major scene. That last 20 minutes is, holy shit.
Well, I knew it was coming.
No, we all know it's coming if you follow the comics, especially if you read the Ultimate comics. You know it's coming, but still, it's holy shit.
Well, I think the thing that a lot of the people that have a problem with this movie have to remember is since they are trying to have some loyalty to the comic books, they have to do Electro. They have to involve Electro, and they have to get him out of the way. And for as weak of a character as he is, I think they did about as good as they're going to do.
My feeling on it a little different. I think people don't like the movie because I think most of the people bitching about the movie are people that go see Thor and Iron Man 2. And what's the other ones they do? Captain America. And they're a little more adult. Guns. There's bullets going off every 2 minutes. This is a more family-friendly series, the Spider-Man series.
It's not even about family-friendly. There's just not really that many
more for families, though, Spider-Man. It is. It's built that way. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but I think some of these jaded 22-year-olds that want everything to be edgy don't like the fact that Spider-Man's not edgy anymore. He's emo. Which he is. And you know what? It works. And it works really well. Mark Webb's a fucking genius. I didn't have Mark Waters. I didn't have any more time with Mark to tell him this, but I hope Mark Waters had something to do with discovering Mark Webb when he did 500 Days of Summer. Because the guy went from 500 Days of Summer to Amazing Spider-Man and kills it.
Well, I just hope with the route that they're going with these movies, yeah. I think they're doing a really good job of kind of making it like a comic book, keeping that, like I said, a little bit childish, but that's the nature of what a comic book is.
Sure. Well, it also depends a lot on how they do the future films.
Well,
that's where I'm kind of like, uh-oh.
I think if they ever incorporate, I know they're going to incorporate Venom at some point, but if they ever do the Carnage and Venom, that's where I think you're going to see some darkness come out of the movies, yeah. And I think they got to do, hopefully.
Well, I think they're doing separate movies.
Well, I told
Venom,
they're supposedly going to have
no,
a
they are doing.
Venom.
Oh,
you
they
looked
are
it up?
Doing.
You found out?
This is something they announced when they announced the sequels. They're doing Sinister Six. They're doing Venom separately. They may be involved in the Spider-Man world, obviously, but I don't know if Venom's even going to be in the third movie. They haven't talked about it yet.
No, they're not releasing a
I'm
whole lot
I'm a fan
about
of Venom.
All we know is that Rhino's going to be in it.
Well, we do know that'll happen. By the way, I think the soundtrack for that movie was great. I think the first soundtrack's great. Mark Webb's soundtrack for 500 Days of Summer's great. The guy knows music. The guy knows emotion. And like I said to you after the movie, the original writers of the first three Spider-Man movies, I don't think they got laid in high school. I think Mark Webb got laid. And I think his writers got laid because they get emotions. They get why this relationship between Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone works so much better. There's so much more heat and chemistry than Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst. It's not even funny.
I think that maybe it can also come down to not just the writing, but the quality of the actor and just the natural chemistry they have together.
I think that you can't argue it. But, I mean, I've been listening to the soundtrack at the gym all week. It's great.
I actually just downloaded the Godzilla soundtrack last night on Spotify.
I haven't listened to it yet. Is it good?
Well, I mean, it's not like...
Is it all instrumental?
Yeah, it's instrumental. But
the whole thing?
Yeah, but it's great.
I'm going to see if it's on here. Godzilla.
It's on.
Oh, there's like 5,000 things called Godzilla. Here it is.
Godzilla 2014.
Yeah, I got it right here.
Puffy Combs has got...
there's no Puffy... There's no P. Diddy song on this one.
Thank God.
You don't remember that one?
Oh, I remember.
I remember. Here's the thing I hate about downloading soundtracks before the movie's out. They title all the soundtrack songs based off the scenes, and it's kind of like spoiler fucking alert. Okay?
Yeah, well...
Okay, when I just saw the last song in there, it's called Back to the Ocean. I don't want to read that. I don't want to read that, because you know what that tells me? Motherfucker, don't die. He's going back to the fucking ocean.
You know he's going to the ocean.
And here's the problem. No one gives a shit about this issue because only nerds download the movie soundtracks anyways. So they're like, all the regular people are like, well, maybe you shouldn't listen to gay instrumental music.
Play two against one.
All right, I will. You just spoiled something else.
Come on.
So much spoiler going on. I can't wait to see this. Vegas Aftermath. I don't want to see that.
Well, why are you watching it?
I'm turning it off.
You're like the guy that's looking at the fucking penthouse going, oh, my God, look, there's tits. I don't want to see this. And then you flip to the next page and go, oh, there's a vagina. Why am I looking at this?
No, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
I can't look at it anymore because I don't want everything spoiled for me.
Listen, all I got to say is, can you name one Godzilla movie where he dies? out of like the 47 that they made.
No, but they're giving you like when you look at that soundtrack listing.
All right, let's just move on.
They're not.
This.
I'm just saying when you look at that soundtrack listing, they're not really covering anything up.
No.
By the way, for those who don't remember the old Godzilla film from 98, 99.
Oh, the one with.
Yeah, here's this soundtrack. A little different. Rage Against the Machine.
I went and saw this movie by myself. I had my mom drop me off at the movie theater and go watch it.
I finally saw the end of that movie last year. It took me 12 years to get through the whole thing.
It's terrible.
I've fallen asleep during it numerous times.
No, it's terrible. I like the idea that it's going to lay eggs inside, like, New York, like, really?
And that's when I fell asleep. You would think that's the best part of the movie.
No, they absolutely bastardized, like, the entire Godzilla thing. And then they, okay, and then they, like, the little, like, Godzilla Raptor things running around all over the place, like, really? What?
Yeah, they trapped them all in the, was it the Silver Dome?
Yeah,
you
whatever
know what?
It was.
You could make an argument. Man, I hate saying this. This is how bad the movie is. You could make the argument that the soundtrack's the best thing about the movie.
Oh, man.
You could make an argument that is lackluster as the soundtrack is. It's better than the shitty movie. Come on, Matthew Broderick versus Godzilla. I'm kind of good. I'm good on that.
The worm guy.
Yeah.
Did you ever see the cartoon they made afterwards?
No.
They made a Godzilla cartoon afterwards, and everybody calls him, "Oh, you're the worm guy," and he like he's all buddy buddy with Godzilla, and it like helps him fight like other monsters.
Remember this one?
Can you play the puppy one?
This is actually the best song off the soundtrack. We Could Be Heroes.
This was from Seventh Heaven.
No,
Seventh Heaven. What's the deal with Seventh Heaven?
What's the deal with Louise?
I don't know. I'm losing
it. Who said Seventh Heaven?
It sounds like a Seventh Heaven, like, bring it.
You don't like the Wallflowers? Wallflowers are pretty cool.
I love the Wallflowers.
I like them. Jacob Dylan, not cool.
It's a 90s band.
Black dolphins can swim. They all make that same noise in the 90s.
I'll tell you what. It's no Dennis DeYoung.
Oh, you want to hear the Puffy song?
It's no Dennis DeYoung.
No.
It's no Hall and Oates for that matter.
Nothing Dennis DeYoung. All right. I just remember when this song came out, the uproar everyone was in because Jimmy Page was, one, involved, and two, that Puffy would have the balls to sample this song. This pissed so many people off.
It pissed me off.
Remember how many people this pissed off? You just have to hear it. Like,
I don't get pissed off.
He secretly loves it.
No.
He does. He drives around the Ford.
Did I ever tell you what he listens to, like, all the time?
Miley Cyrus?
No, it's the same, like, 14 songs. So, every time I drive with Luisi, and I've just decided this is all he listens to. Bush.
Oh,
don't
yeah.
even lie. Don't
oh,
even
yeah.
lie.
I'm a huge
and
Bush fan.
And it's the same album. No, I'm pretty sure it's the same album.
No, but the CD was stuck in the...
You know,
the CD
listen.
Was stuck in your rental in L.A.
Listen.
It somehow made its way out to L.A.
I can't bitch too much.
They got great.
If you go to my Spotify playlist, yeah. I go from Slipknot to Mudvayne to Korn. Hold on, listen,
Korn's
listen,
fantastic.
Listen. No. Slipknot, Mudvayne to Korn.
So like Mozart.
I
understand.
Swan Lake, Dance of the Swans, Waltz D flat major.
That's
I
not
mean,
my point. My point like, is all.
Right,
he,
then I go to EDM music.
No, Mikey. All he listens to is Bush. There's no other bands.
Listen.
I'm not saying there's no EDM. There's
wouldn't
no
you
blues.
Love? Wouldn't you love the ability to listen to the same 14 songs every day, and every day you think it's new?
And he has that ability. He's Drew Barrymore in 51st Date, and that Bush album just came out on the day he got conked on the head.
We're going down Sunset Boulevard West, and then coming back east the same song.
Drives me crazy. Oh.
You know what? I told Barb. I called Barb, and I gave her a line about her wall with the Sarah McLachlan.
Yeah.
And even she thought it was funny.
Johnny Manziel got drafted by Cleveland.
Yeah, he went the 12th round or something.
Ouch.
No, he went like 12th pick, but Cleveland? Oh. Have fun with that.
Hey,
remember the movie Draft
Day?
Have fun with that. Enjoy Cleveland, pal.
Goes to show you how many people really wanted Manziel.
Well, we were talking outside after draft day, and we're like, why'd this movie bomb? Oh, yeah. Who gives a fuck about Cleveland?
Oh, that's right. I forgot it was Cleveland.
Yeah, who gives a fuck about Cleveland?
Oh, wait. And Cleveland got Johnny Manziel?
Yeah. Cleveland, with the 22nd pick in the draft, chose Johnny Manziel. Johnny Football went 22nd.
That is eerily similar to the movie.
Mel Kiper's like flipping out right now. He's like, why didn't he go first?
That is eerily similar to the movie.
Isn't it kind of crazy?
Yeah.
And it's also eerily similar to when they drafted Brady Quinn, and I don't remember that working out that well for them either.
No.
You know, let me ask you a question. Do you think when it comes to these giant star players that because of salary caps and stuff like that, there's going to be a growing trend of if you're that big of a player, you're not – because this happened to a quarterback last year.
Oh, that they're going to go with someone else because they could pay him less?
Right, where instead of drafting the star quarterback where they're going to have to pay an $8 million bonus, the number one draft pick is going to be like a tight end or a lineman.
Oh, yeah.
They can get away with
if saying, you're really cheap,
because, my point is that if you're a lineman,
Bears,
okay, you need an O-line or you need D-line, whatever it is, there's no lineman getting a $20 million signing bonus or something crazy.
They are, but they're not getting what a quarterback's getting.
But
right.
Yeah,
I mean,
you know what I'm saying? I wonder if they're doing that on purpose these days.
Oh, yeah, it scares them away.
Well, there's one other thing I wanted to talk about before we wrap up. We got about a couple minutes left. So, first of all, saw the thing you posted about the mayor. Fuck him, Rahm Emanuel.
Oh, dude, yeah.
But that's not even – here's what I want to talk about.
Wait, real quick. Was it running the red lights or the new 360-degree
both things,
cameras?
Both things. Chucky posted a red light when you posted the camera one.
He parked at a handicap spot in front of Stella Rose Bar.
Ah, fuck him. Oh, no, well, that they have to do for protection, whatever. But here's the deal. So this is what fires me up about this fucking guy. This city goes into outrage. And by the way, I love hot dogs. Can I say I love hot dogs? I think Doug Sahn created, here's what he did for the restaurant business. First of all, he brought food to Avondale, which I don't think anyone would have thought of doing in the world, okay? He brought like legitimate fast food that you couldn't get anywhere else that was done real well, high quality sausages, okay? And this is before everyone was doing it. So Doug needs some props for this, okay? Yes, Doug hasn't exactly caught up with the times and like kept improving. It's the same place it's always been since the late 90s. But here's the deal. Okay, so Doug Sahn announces this week, hot dogs, he's done with it in October. He's moving on. He makes $2 million a year off the place. He could probably retire or start a million other businesses. Okay, cool. Why are more people flipping out about fucking hot dogs closing in October? Then Rahm Emanuel closing schools in Chicago. Then Rahm Emanuel running red lights. Then Rahm Emanuel parking in handicap spaces or putting in cameras that do 360-degree views. Why are more people flipping out about a fucking hot dog stand closing? Like I said, no disrespect to Doug. I think Doug would 1,000% agree with me. Okay, by the way, I think Doug would say, yeah, that's kind of stupid. A hot dog stand closes, which, by the way, Franken Dogs is like 2 miles away. You could get your pretty much very similar hot dogs fix there, okay? It's just whatever. But Rahm Emanuel pulls all this fucking bullshit. Nobody cares.
Well, you know, I think part of the problem is that, one, our generation, when they look at stuff like the 360 cameras, and they go, well, whatever, you know, it's whatever. I mean, it's fine. It's their government. We can trust them.
Oh, who trusts the government?
What people don't realize is that all the government is a group of people, just like you, me, your neighbor, the creepy guy down the street. It's not like...
Why'd you look at me like when you said the creepy guy down the street?
Because you're fucking creepy. Because, you know, it's not like, you know,
no, you're
like,
right.
Like some sort of higher being or something.
Right. No,
they're just
right.
Normal people. And you're giving normal, everyday people this ability to spy and gather all this information. And I think a lot of the younger generation that's just hot on social media, because if you look, when I posted that, everybody who like commented on me or sent me messages on it, they're all like over 40.
Oh, right. Listen, I just think it's not that young people trust the government. I don't think they give a shit. like literally don't give a shit. I'm not saying they don't give a shit like, oh, who cares? I think they're nihilists. I think most of the kids growing up our age, 18 to 30, are fucking nihilists. I think they don't give a fuck. The world could end tomorrow, and they're all okay with it. Like, I literally think so many people our age are kind of like, yeah, it ends when it ends. Fuck it. That's why I party every night. That's why I live my life.
Downers
That's
grow.
Why I'm a superstar.
I think there actually might be a lot of truth to that.
Yeah.
But I don't think they even know if they're conscious to it. I think it's just
No, no, it may be subconscious, but I think a lot of kids have fucking give it up. Like, they just don't give a fuck.
Downers Grove has a light or a camera on every
I know. I
corner.
Saw they put those in now.
And that's why there's no cops.
I saw that sitting
in their bunker.
Well, you know what's cute about that? When cops start losing their jobs, because we don't need to pay them. Wait.
But when that happens, magically his taxes will still go up.
Oh, yeah, especially in Illinois. Let me tell you what else, too. They're all arguing about this $15 minimum wage. Not that I don't disagree with you. That would be amazing, $15
minimum
wage. Not a chance.
It's not going to happen.
Well, forget that. What they don't understand is, no, let's say it did happen. It could happen. I'm going to be ordering my McDonald's off an electronic menu, and there's going to be one person working there who puts all the orders in a fucking bag and hands it to me. I'm telling you, that's what's going to happen. And all these kids that start their careers at McDonald's, Burger King, White Castle, all those places, they're going to be shit out of fucking luck.
Well, I think what people forget, too, is that it's minimum wage.
Yeah, you're right.
Like, listen, I know you could be living in the middle of nowhere in the country somewhere, which, by the way, the cost of living is a whole lot less.
Yeah, I was going to say, McDonald's, $15 an hour in Tulsa, Oklahoma, you're rich.
Yeah, you might be
you
mayor.
You might as well be mayor.
Here,
right?
I'll give you an example. Where my
you
buddy's
parking the handicap.
Down a mountain home, Arkansas.
Yeah, right.
There's 50,000 people down there. You're an hour and a half, 2 hours from Branson, Missouri.
Yeah.
My point is that $500 a month gets you like a 2,700 square foot house.
Listen, I'm not going to say this is my opinion. I don't think this is my opinion, but I do think this is the flip side of the coin. I haven't developed this enough to have an opinion. Here's the flip side of the coin. You flip burgers at Burger King,
mm-hmm.
and you get to make $50,000 a year, but no one's raising what I'm getting as a writer, director, actor at my guilds. So I sell a project, and I make $40,000 or $50,000 a year. Typically, I kind of work harder than you do, and I'm making more money for my business than you do. You just flip burgers. And my job is much more rare to succeed at than flipping burgers. Anyone can flip burgers. Not everyone can write and direct. So how is that fair then for the people who aren't making minimum wage right now because they've earned not to make minimum wage, like you, Mikey, like you, Alex? Are you making minimum wage?
No.
So how would you feel if burger flippers at Burger King are now making $50,000 a year because they get $15 an hour, and your salary don't change?
For the record, $15 an hour is not $50,000 a year.
I'm just saying. No, but it's
28.
No. But what I'm saying is $15 an hour is $15 an hour, and your salary don't change at all, is what I'm saying to you.
Yeah.
How do you feel?
Well, here's the problem. I think people... Oh, I'm going to sound so horrible for this. If you're making $15 an hour and you're not like some old retired person, you're obviously working at a capacity that you're not going to get above, okay?
Let's just say the world needs ditch diggers.
I guess you can say that, and that's more of an indirect way. But my point in saying is if your goal in life is to make minimum wage and that's all you're going to do, I mean, come on.
More power
now,
to you.
Now, what I think a lot of people at minimum wage lose out on, and they don't realize, is that you are the bottom rung of the middle class, if you will.
Right.
All right. And what a lot of people don't realize is how things get affected. You raise the
Go ahead, make your point.
You raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Guess what? The cost of goods and services are going up. The cost of this is going up. The cost of that going up.
Taxes are going to go up.
My point I've been making is at the end of the day, guess what? Rich people, millionaires, they got enough money to absorb the increases. They got enough money to
the
absorb
the only people
everything.
That get fucked by raising the minimum
are
wage
the people making
are
minimum
class
wage.
People who, by the way, we've been talking about for like, isn't the argument the last like 5 years middle class is getting fucked over?
Yeah.
Well, by raising minimum wage, you know who gets fucked over again? The middle class.
Right.
So yeah, lower class now gets $15 an hour, and that's sweet shit for them. But nothing really happens to the 1%. Nothing happens to the 10%.
And all these
it's
people,
the middle class,
and the other people,
fucked.
The other thing they don't realize is these people who are making minimum wage, they're getting money from the government. Mm-hmm. Guess what? Now you're making $15 an hour. Bye bye, assistance.
Well, we're gonna leave you. Thank you to Mark Waters, Mean Girls, Vampire Academy. You could catch it on DVD, Blu-ray, May 20th, and video on demand. I will be interviewing good old JR, Jim Ross, on the 14th. And we will see you then. I'll be at the Squared Circle, I think. I'm going to talk to Lisa tomorrow. I think
she's great.
I think that's a go. So, Jim Roth, great show coming up. And we will talk to you guys next Wednesday.